Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is The Thread Interview, a new twist on book talk. Elliot Ackerman has spent a lot of time in the midst of complicated conflicts, first as a Marine in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now as a journalist and novelist. So you might assume that his fiction is about war, and indeed, he has set both of his novels within war zones. But the stories told there are about love and loss, deception, ambition, and emotional ambivalence. Elliot Ackerman's new novel is titled Dark at the Crossing, and he joins us this morning from Washington. And welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
I do get the sense that you're quite deliberate about not writing battlefield fiction, which I want to say can be every bit as human and complex as setting a story just outside of it. But it sounds like you make a deliberate choice on that. And why is it?
I don't know if it's necessarily that it is a deliberate choice, although I am acutely aware what I am drawn to and the subjects that I'm drawn to are not the traditional battlefield narratives. And oftentimes I find, you know, the stories that I'm writing are set in and around conflict. But, you know, the type of writing that I endeavor to put out is similar to the type of books that I like to read, and I've always loved books that deal with complex political issues, but that then are able through character and story to distill them down to their emotional truths and to make them accessible. So, you know, that's what I tried to do in my first novel, Green on Blue. And that's also what I've tried to do here with this new book, Dark at the Crossing.
I mean, this new book, though, for as influential as the conflict is in what is happening in this story, the conflict in Syria, I should say, we're not in the middle of the battles, and we've kind of got a side view, I think, of the terrible consequences of war. Is that a fair way to say this?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it. You know, I think that what fiction does better than any other medium, I believe, is it allows you to really drill down on questions. And, you know, the books that I admire the most don't necessarily, they're not trying to be pedantic and answer those questions, but they sort of lay them out cleanly. And so, you know, writing journalism, being around the Syrian civil war, one of the things that very quickly became evident to me was that many of the revolutionary activists I came to know were in this position of incredible moral and emotional conflict, in so much as they had in 2011 and 2012 gone out into the streets in nonviolent protest to demand democratic reforms against an autocratic regime. It was sort of an irrefutable cause. I mean, how can you begrudge them for doing that? But then as the revolution floundered and really turned into a war, just an outright war, their cause was basically a failure. It ended up destroying their homes. They had to then flee their homes, and many of them never knew if they would return. And so that internal conflict that you would see with so many of them, which was just evident, which was these actions I took, you know, demanding my rights, which I'm extremely proud of, led to one of the greatest tragedies of my life. And so then it forms this question, you know, how do people live with an experience that is so defines them but also draws them into such internal conflict? And so the characters in the book, and I actually think it's a pretty quiet book, you know, as you learn about their backstories, each of them is facing a similar type of internal conflict. And the novel is ultimately about the choices they make when confronted with such turmoil.
It sounds like your conversations with people, let's say at the Syrian border, some of these people that participated in the protests, who said to you, when perhaps you asked, was it worth it, right, given the fact that Assad is still in power, it sounds like the answers to that really influenced the way you thought about how this story was going to develop. What would people say to you if you, did you ask them, was it worth it?
I didn't need to ask them. I mean, that's information that was being volunteered. I would go out to dinner with Syrian friends, And I can remember numerous dinners that all sort of began the same way, which would be, as you know, we were ordering and the entree and the appetizers were being brought out. My Syrian friends, because I would be the one American there, would be sort of aggressively telling me that the U.S. and the West needed to intervene in Syria. They needed to do more for the rebels, that the Free Syrian Army still had a chance, that the regime in the Islamic State didn't hold all the territory in Syria, and that the world is turning its back on Syrians. And then as, you know, we would go into our entree and the dessert would come out, that rhetoric would sort of die down. And we'd be sitting at the end of the meal, and you know, and they would be saying to me, you know, I regret it all. I wish we'd never gone out in the streets. Mm-hmm. I've destroyed my own home.
Wow.
And in writing this book, you know, there were two points. The first one being is I could recognize a similar type of emotional conflict within myself and my experience to our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which there are parts of that experience for me that I'm very, very proud of. But the wreckage that's been left behind in its wake is, I mean, it's irrefutable. You know, those wars have been a disaster in the Middle East. And so I've, in my own life, had to reckon with that. You know, but then as a novelist, you know, I would see amongst Syrian friends and others, you know, this sort of emotional arc taking place in these conversations and seeing what they were wrestling with and just being around the border and watching what people were having to do to survive. And it's, well, how do I bring that home to a reader who's half a world away? The complexities of the politics over there can seem completely impenetrable. So what I'm often doing as a novelist is I'm looking for, you know, what I would guess I would call emotional equivalencies. So, you know, what is this? You know, what is an emotionally similar experience that is relatable to somebody a half a world away? And what quickly became evident to me was that, you know, it was a marriage. And that, you know, in many ways, when two people come together and get married, it's, you know, it's an adventure of the heart. It's two people having a shared vision of what they can become, mm-hmm. and completely upending their worlds to invest themselves in it, to create a new world. And then what happens, though, when a marriage fails and you can no longer believe in that world that you were trying to create? And so the novel, in many respects, when I say it's a quiet novel, it's sort of the story of a failed revolution, but told through the prism of a failed marriage. And you know, if you pick up the book, you'll see central to the story is this marriage that is floundering. So again, the book is kind of working on all of those levels, or at least I tried to make it work on all of those levels.
And you know what phrase kept coming into my mind as I was reading the book, and I think this applies to what you've just said. Do you know Elizabeth Sammet from West Point?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so we've had her on the show a number of times. And
she's great.
She talks about this idea of war vertigo. And that's, I want you to listen to something that she said about this when she was on the show most recently. But that was the sense that I got in reading what these characters were doing and the decisions that they were making in your novel, that but for the kind of conflict that they found themselves in, they might have never guessed that they would have made these kinds of decisions. Okay, so here's Elizabeth Sammet, and then we can talk about it.
We had all been taught for so long to imagine a particular kind of war story, and I know that that's certainly for a long time been part of the preparation my own students receive and the preparation that anyone who grows up to join a military has received from parents and from popular culture and from all sorts of sources. And then when one finds oneself in the middle of it, in the middle of that vertigo, as I've called it, I think that a whole new set of considerations comes into play.
So does that make sense to you, Elliot?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I think that the, you know, when you're talking about any type of narrative, that often our preconceptions will be challenged. You know, and mine most certainly were being around the Syrian civil war. And if anything, what's been really unique about these wars is that it's challenged the American conception of war and how long they can go on. And something that always struck me was, and it surprised me, was there was this sudden kind of realization amongst that I had and that Syrian friends that I have, we would laugh about it, particularly, you know, ones who had been democratic activists, which was a sort of strange notion, was if you think about it in, you know, 2003, 2004, and, you know, and it seems hopelessly naive to say now, but it was the case back then, was, you know, we sent all of our troops overseas to launch a military campaign that, among many other things, was nominally trying to bring democracy to some of these countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that effort went completely off the rails. And if you look at it, and it went off the rails because of, for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons, you know, was the forces of authoritarianism and the rise of radical Islam. And when I would talk to many of my Syrian friends who'd engaged in the revolution there in 2011 and 2012, you know, they had gone out into the streets to demand democratic reforms, and their revolution had been taken off the rails by the very same forces, you know, authoritarianism and radical Islam. And we would look at one another and say, you know, in some weird ways, we're almost veterans of the same war. And that was something that I didn't expect to find, sympathy. And we were in some ways reckoning with the same type of conflict with what those experiences meant for us.
Yeah. And I guess that's why what, you know, West Point literature professor Elizabeth Samet says about, I don't want to say standard, but predictable kind of story to tell out of war. And I feel like novelists like you and Phil Clay, who I think is a friend of yours, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are revealing more about that idea of war vertigo.
Yeah, I think we're trying to in these stories. A lot of what's in these stories, you know, at least what I'm writing, I'm not necessarily tapping into war or my experiences in the war. I'm tapping into, what it means to be in a relationship. In my first book, Green on Blue, which was about these two Afghan brothers, you know, I was thinking about what it means to be a brother and my own brother much more than I was thinking about, you know, some patrol I'd been on in Afghanistan 5 years before. And that was sort of very much the emotional core of the book. And so at times I feel a little bit guarded in that I don't want readers to see too much of the war or too much of my experiences in works that are frankly fictitious and just works of imagination, but that's always the age old question in literature. You know, how much is the novelist's life, and how much is and how much is just imagination?
Well, I know, and I've talked about this with other writers that novelists often hate the question that says, "Okay, so this is really about you, right?" Which really diminishes the power of the novelist's imagination. I don't ever ask that.
Well, it's funny too, though, because for a novelist, it's also can be a little bit disingenuous pretend like it's not.
That's right.
I was listening to the Turkish novelist Orhan Pamuk speak. We did a panel together in Washington about a year ago, mm-hmm. and someone asked him, how much of these characters are you and how much are somebody else? And he pointed to his house and literally screamed, "It's me. It's all me."
Oh, really?
Which in some ways is true because, these characters are inhabiting your imagination. So you're pulling some part of, yourself or your experience and placing them into the characters. I remember I did a reading for Green on Blue with Anthony Mara, who wrote a very beautiful book called A Constellation for Vital Phenomena. And after the reading, we were just talking about our work, and he said, "So what are you working on, Elliot? Your next book is going to be another war novel." And I said, "Well, respectfully, Anthony, I don't think Green on Blue is a war novel. It's a story about two brothers set in Afghanistan." And he kind of laughed at me and said, "Elliot, you fought in Afghanistan. You wrote a novel set in Afghanistan. You wrote a war novel." And I said, "Okay, Tony, fair enough. But, and Tony's book is set in Chechnya around the war. The whole book's set in Grozny. He didn't spend much time there and went to Iowa." And I said, "But, then you wrote a war novel, Tony." And he sort of looked at me as though it had never occurred to him that he had written a war novel.
Two guys who didn't write war novels telling each other you wrote a war novel, right?
But it's often funny to kind of just and that's the great thing about writing books is everyone's gonna read them differently when they go out in the world.
This is the Thread interview. Elliot Ackerman is with us. His new novel is called Dark at the Crossing. This novel is set at the Syrian-Turkish border, and I'm really grateful for what you tell about that, because I don't think I'd ever had the complete image of what this place is like. Your description of these abandoned and wild children that live there, I think really meaningful in the midst of this debate that's going on around Syrian refugees. Can I ask you to just describe what the border is like, and then we can talk about these kids and the people that live there?
Well, I think one of the things that's the most striking about the Syrian border and about, you know, the Syrian civil war in particular, is how easy it is to get there. That's what sort of blew me away when I started spending a lot of time. You know, when I was in the military, it seemed very difficult to get to the wars because you're doing it with the U.S. military. So you would go to a base, you'd fly from one air base to another air base to a third air base. You'd wait for 2 days, you'd get on another plane. It took forever. And, you know, as someone who's gone there as a novelist and a journalist, just as a singleton, I mean, it's a direct flight from, if you're on the East Coast, from New York or Washington, or even if you're on the West Coast, from Los Angeles to Istanbul. And then you take a 45-minute internal flight from Istanbul to Gaziantep, and then Aleppo is a 90-minute cab ride. So to me, that was really striking, was just how I could, you know, if I was on the East Coast, I could, you know, leave my house in the morning, and if I had my tickets booked, you know, I could be in Syria by the next one day in the afternoons, you know, within 24 hours. So, and I think that was striking, not only just because it makes your head spin, but also politically, you realize, as we've seen, this war in particular has been one that has kind of taken all comers, from very young freelance journalists to jihadis to, you know, to secular activists who've wanted to go support the Free Syrian Army. It's really kind of become a melange of fighters. And that's what you see at the border, and was really striking. And, and the realization that nobody knows how this is going to end. And there's been people sitting there since 2012, 2013, thinking that any day this war is going to end, and they're still waiting. And so there really are so many people who are just existing in this liminal state, and so many of them are stalled at this border.
It's so – what you just said about it's a war that takes all comers. I mean, this is something you're exploring with one of your main characters, who decides his sister doesn't need him anymore. He's going to go fight for the Free Syrian Army and what it's going to be like to cross that border. But – that also upends our image of what wars and battlefields are, doesn't it? Maybe this is really more the contemporary idea of war.
If you've ever read Anna Karenina, there's a passage at the end of it, not to give you the spoiler alert here, but...
well, if we haven't read it by now, well,
right.
Go ahead.
And it's so long, by the time you begin the book, you'll forget what I told you. But the way it ends, you know, Anna's lover is this guy Vronsky, and Anna kills herself. And at the end of the book, Vronsky is, you know, distraught, grieving, but he kind of doesn't know what to do. And he used to be a soldier, a profession he'd given up for her. And the last scene Tolstoy writes of the book is basically a report that Vronsky is seen on a train heading to the Caucasus to go fight in the war. And you sort of realize it's almost as though he's going to commit his own sort of type of suicide in this war. I mean, this is not—he's not someone who's going off to fight for, you know, with a rose in his cap and idealistic reasons. Right. It's kind of there's a real darkness to what he's going to do. And I think that people can project onto wars in many respects kind of whatever they want, whether it's that darkness, whether it's all of their idealism. It really can sort of become a Rorschach test for how someone is viewing the world. And I, you know, certainly saw that being in and around, you know, Syria, you know, and present day Iraq. You know, those two conflicts are really intertwined, and so it really has attracted all comers.
So these bands of kids who kind of run wild and form their own, I guess what I thought of as kind of families. Are they mm-hmm. there? I mean, is that what you will encounter at the border today?
Times I've been there, you see obviously refugees with all of their possessions packed up, trying to figure out where to go, and then you see communities that have sprouted up around the border, people living in under plastic tarps, living on the side of the literally living on the side of the road, and then amongst those communities too, you'll see lots of children just sort of running wild.
Are these children, I mean, are their parents there, or have many of these kids just ended up somehow by themselves at the border?
I think it depends. Some with parents, some with extended family, and some that have been orphaned by themselves or brought out in groups. So it's, you know, it's a conflict that has left a huge degree of wreckage in its wake. And it's, you know, there really is, at least from what I've observed, truly a lost generation in Syria.
Wow.
I mean, the idea alone that, you know, these kids haven't been going to school since 2012.
I'd love to hear some insight from you as you've taken note of and maybe you've written about the debate that has gone on, not just in the United States about taking in Syrian refugees, but also in Europe. I mean, we're seeing a lot of a political upheaval, I think, flow out of some of these decisions in Europe and perhaps here as well. What do you make of that?
I think it's tough, and I wrestle with it. And I would be loath to sit here and give you strong views and pretend that I saw clearly what the solution was for this refugee crisis, because it is so complex, and everyone has different equities invested in it. So, you know, on the one hand, you have Europe and how in many of these European countries taking in these massive numbers of Syrian refugees has proved somewhat destabilizing to those countries, at least culturally destabilizing. And those are countries that, despite whatever progressive values we might have as Americans or at least espouse to have, you know, they do not have that tradition of accepting refugees. You know, there isn't a heritage of wanting to welcome the huddled masses in places like France and Germany. So I think those countries, amongst many issues, are kind of going through an existential crisis, to include questioning their values with regards to taking in refugees. And those are issues that the people in those countries are going to have to decide what they want their policies to be. You know, then you have Turkey, which has taken in massive numbers of Syrian refugees, and Erdogan has very astutely or cynically, depending on your perspective, he is using that for leverage, not only with Europe but also with the United States to allow him an internal crackdown on his politics. So, you know, he's been arresting journalists. He's about to rewrite the Turkish constitution. And he's able to do all of this without anyone in the West, Europe or the United States, saying much of anything to him, because he is the one kind of stemming the massive flow of refugees into Europe. If Erdogan decides to open up his borders, Europe would be completely flooded with Syrian refugees. You know, and then you have our country where, you know, we're prosecuting wars in Iraq and in Syria. You know, are we ready to take in all of these refugees? And the numbers that we've taken in are really, you know, pretty nominal.
They're small, right?
Yeah, compared to the whole process or compared to the whole problem. So, you know, these are, and all of this in a backdrop, which is you have wars going on in the Middle East now that are, you know, more akin to the 30 years war. I mean, this is a struggle. It's an existential struggle for what the future of the Middle East is going to look like, not only politically, you know, but also culturally with regards to Islam. You know, are more fundamental strains of Islam going to carry the day, more intolerant strains, or are we going to see more progressive strains emerge? So these are the questions of our time, and they're all interrelated. And I feel like one just has to watch, or get involved. But there's no easy policy solution to any of this because it's so complex.
Have you been having, and maybe you haven't specifically been writing about this, but have you been having conversations with the sources that you've developed in the Middle East about the way that President Trump talks about that existential struggle that you've just been talking about and where Islam fits into that?
I don't think anyone in the Middle East, you know, is particularly enthusiastic about President Trump's rhetoric surrounding Islam and surrounding the ideas of a Muslim ban, that I don't think it makes us, you know, particularly stronger. So I think on the one hand, people are reticent, particularly around his rhetoric. You know, on the other hand, many people in the Middle East were very, very frustrated with President Obama and felt that his inaction led to the current crisis in Syria being as bad as it is. So, you know, we have between Bush and Obama kind of sense of commission and sense of omission. You know, I've often felt that if you were to look at the Bush presidency, you could say the greatest strategic blunder George W. Bush made during his presidency was putting the troops into Iraq. But you could also say that the great strategic blunder President Obama made was pulling all of the troops out of Iraq, meaning if we'd left 10,000 or residual force there, You might not have seen the Islamic State sweep in the way that it has, and that's been incredibly destabilizing. I was recently in Iraq in October doing a magazine piece and went to Fallujah and was in Mosul. And amongst Iraqis, there was a pretty strong consensus that they wished the U.S. had not turned its back so swiftly on them.
I'm having a conversation with Elliot Ackerman. He is a former Marine who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, now a journalist and a novelist, and we're talking about his new novel just out called Dark at the Crossing. As it happens, you served in Iraq under General James Mattis, didn't you, for a time?
I did. He was my division commander.
He is now President Trump's defense secretary. What kind of an influence do you think he'll be on the president?
I mean, I think it's yet to be seen what type of an influence. You know, he's well respected amongst those in the military. He's very colorful. My interactions with him, I mean, I was a second lieutenant, so, you know, I didn't interact with him directly, but he was very fond of gathering all of the Marines around a tank. He would park a tank and give us speeches from the top of a tank as opposed to a regular dais. And he would say things like, you know, when you go out there and kill the enemy, you fine young gentlemen. You know, he would always say, you fine young gentlemen, you know, when he was telling us all the horrible things we were going to go do. So he'd always end up, you fine young gentlemen. So he was very colorful. The Marines liked him. It's tough to know. You know, there's so many levels between you and a division commander when you're a young officer. But he seemed popular. But I think there's an interesting question is, you know, why, and, you know, there was a lot made of this a few months ago, is, you know, why was Trump appointing so many military officers? And, you know, as someone who's served in the military, there was some ink spilled about, is this the new Trump junta? And, you know, I didn't give that a lot of credit. I mean, if anyone understands and the importance of oftentimes of having civilian control of the military, it's people in the military. But to me, it was sort of, you know, what does this say about Trump? Why does he find so many of these folks appealing as opposed to other individuals? I think that's because, you know, maybe he admires their experience or the way they carry themselves. And I think that having someone strong, you know, a strong Secretary of Defense, at least their personality is strong, and they're not going to be a pushover, and they're their own person, is probably a good thing.
You know, you've just given me, though, with that little anecdote about Mattis out in the field, maybe some insight on this, because Donald Trump is not somebody who turns away from drama, right? He appreciates that, and it sounds like Mattis has kind of a threat of that in his personality. And maybe that's part of what appealed to Donald Trump about him.
Yeah, I think General Mattis certainly has his own cultivated swagger.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, there are a lot of Marine generals, and when he was a two-star general when I served under him, and there are many two-star generals in the Marine Corps, but he was certainly a famous and very well-known one.
I'm not going to say we mentioned spoiler alerts earlier when we were talking about Anna Karenina, and I am not going to give anything away about the ending. But I am going to tell you that I thought about it for weeks after I finished the book. And I kept wondering how you decided what it took to get to the point that you knew that's how you were going to close the novel, or if you knew that from the beginning.
It's interesting when you're writing a book, you really never know how it's all going to come together, you know. Books for me and writing, you know, will start with something very small. My last book literally started with the first sentence. That sentence kind of was rattling around my head, and that kind of the book started unwinding from there. With this novel, Dark at the Crossing, the opening scene when Harris goes down to the border is what really kind of began the book. And then in the process of writing it, actually, I'm always reading and often looking, you know, looking for, you know, in other books things, you know, whether it's just something you'll read, a peculiarity of a character or something, you know, oftentimes these things are flooding in. I'm always kind of, I guess, taking in my various culture, you know, whatever form it is, films, movies. And so if you want a little bit of extra credit there, I was reading Seamus Heaney's Nobel Prize acceptance speech, you know, the great Irish poet. And he tells an anecdote in that speech that really kind of stayed with me. And as I was thinking about the anecdote that he told in that speech, the ending of the book came to me.
Wow.
And I was about halfway, into writing the novel. And then I knew how it ended. But then it was difficult. Actually, the challenge became getting to that end point. I never really know. I think, you know, you just sort of as you're writing, you have to have your eyes open and you have to be thinking deeply. And hopefully it comes to you.
But I mean, you know that the reader was probably pulling in the opposite direction. Do you know that?
I think so. Someone told me the other day that my who had read an advance copy of the book said, "I really enjoyed your book. I was depressed for 3 days after reading it."
Okay. See?
So
this is not...
I said, thank you.
Right. Well, and you know why. I mean, this is not... It was crushing.
Well, thank you, but the I think that...
thank you.
You know, at the end of the, you know, when you're sitting there at, with a book and the characters in the book, I think you get to a point where you know them pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And if the story has been unwinding fluidly and it, you know, and you sort of understand what the book is about at that point. And it's sort of like a puzzle that you're putting together. And each of these are pieces. The themes of the book are a set of pieces. The characters are a set of pieces. And eventually you see it. And again, it is this puzzle, and it can only come together in one way.
Okay, so I get the sense that, you know, I get the sense that you don't think this was particularly brave of you as a writer to close it the way you did. I did. I closed the book and thought, wow. What did it take for him to get there? Well, now I know. Now I've asked you about that. Mm-hmm. But it was less of a climb for you than I thought it was.
It sort of becomes, you know, it becomes obvious. You know, by the time you're writing the end of a book, you know, you've been with these characters for a really long time. And you kind of understand the journey that they're on. And, you know, and maybe it doesn't come as a you know, huge surprise to you. So, I mean, the thing that's important is, I think, to always recognize is, you know, a reader, however quickly you're turning the pages, you know, those pages have existed for days and weeks and months. So it's much more of a slog for the writer. So the force isn't always the same necessarily. So, but I'm glad that the ending resonated with you.
You do a lot of traveling for your journalistic work. And I wonder if you pack along a particular book that, you know, I don't know, gives you comfort when you're away from home, something that's meaningful to you, maybe something that's been on your shelf for a long time.
Sure. I'm actually, amongst those who know me well, it's often remarked upon that I'm a remarkably light packer, that I will go away for, you know, 2 to 3 weeks at a time with, I have this one little sort of handheld, almost like duffel that I carry with me everywhere. I've had for probably 7 or 8 years now, and a backpack. So in that backpack, usually, I've kind of got this hideous orange thing I've been carting around for the last probably 18 months, you know, my laptop, a notebook, and then whatever I'm reading. I'll often have sort of a slim book that I've read before that I'm carting around with me too, for a long time. And I know this is horribly cliche, but it was The Old Man and the Sea. I mean, I love that book. I just love it.
You just didn't want to tell me that.
I know, crucify me, but I love the book. It's a great book. Anyone who says otherwise is lying. Mm. And but, you know, I'll switch it out. I was rereading The Catcher in the Rye probably 4 or 5 months ago, which I hadn't really read since high school. You know, it's an interesting book, actually. I got interested in reading it again because someone made the point to me that, you know, that's J.D. Salinger's war novel.
Oh, wow. I haven't read it since high school either, and I've never had the desire to go back. What drew you back to it? Because,
you know, there's a piece just about Salinger around the time he died, and around the time some of his unpublished works were coming out. And just the point was made that, you know, The Catcher in the Rye is sort of J.D. Salinger's. You can read it as a war novel. I mean, you know, if you read it as Holden Caulfield sort of being the dejected veteran J.D. Salinger, and if you know anything about Salinger's, you know, biography, I mean, he landed on D-Day in the first wave on Utah Beach, And, you know, the last line of The Catcher in the Rye is he's, you know, Holden Caulfield's talking about his brother, and he says, you know, don't tell anybody anything or else you'll start missing everybody. And it's sort of this riff on, you know, can be read as this riff of Salinger kind of not wanting to talk about any of his wartime experiences because he starts missing everybody. So that point was, you know, was made to me, and it kind of just made me want to revisit the book because I'd never read it through that light. Actually, as you mentioned, Phil Klein and I will sometimes, if we're in New York, we'll meet for a drink at the White Horse Tavern, which is a very famous literary bar down around the West Village. And apparently, as the story goes, is shortly after World War II, Norman Mailer used to drink there a lot. And it was right about the time The Naked and the Dead came out. And apparently Mailer would sit there at night and he would be getting drunk at the bar and he would be telling these big stories about everything he'd done in the South Pacific during the war. But if you know anything about Mailer's biography, you know, he was a ship's cook in the South Pacific and really never saw much of anything. And so allegedly sitting there at one other far corner of the bar, you know, this is, you know, Mailer was famous. The Naked and the Dead was his bestseller, was this young, unknown, aspiring writer who would be sitting there getting drunk. Just getting drunk enough so he could come up to Mailer and basically tell Mailer he was full of it, and the two of them would fight every night. And that writer was J.D. Salinger.
Ah, wow. No, I've never heard that.
So, yeah.
Elliot, thank you. Thanks very much, and best of luck with the novel.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carrie.
Elliot Ackerman's new novel is called Dark at the Crossing.